Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
There's a way in which I can watch people get defensive of their own inner lives.
Yeah.
When confronted with the kinds of structural truth that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of things about that. One is that I want, you know, the straight white man in your head to I want him to be able to hear that first. It's interesting that the points of connection become the make him feel defensive rather than connected.
Welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. Starting in the 1960s, there's a phrase that started to gain a lot of currency. It was part of the student movement and particularly part of the second wave feminist movement, and it was the personal is political. There's some question about who came up with it, and the authorship of it is unclear, but what is clear is that this became a rallying point, particularly for a lot of women during second wave feminism, in which the personal is political meant something really profound about how they understood their lives in relationship to larger political struggles. And basically, it goes something like this. I'm a woman who, for instance, is not in the workforce. I'm a homemaker. My husband works, and I find that I feel unfulfilled, or I feel oppressed or depressed or put down or ignored or lacking in a certain kind of personal dignity in terms of the autonomy of my life. My husband has total control over the household. I exist as this almost kind of subaltern. I exist as a person who's sort of subordinate to him, and I just don't feel good about my life. Now, there's a few ways to understand the experience of that, right? One way to experience it is I should figure out, you know, maybe an exercise regime, or I should take up a hobby, or I should find some way to feel happier. Another way to understand it, and it's the way that the personal is political pushes people to understand it, is like I am trapped in a system of patriarchy that breeds misery, that my happiness and full human flourishing, my full self-actualization, my full autonomy, my full liberation as a human being to be all I can be is bound up with the political movement to topple the kind of patriarchal structures that produces the world that I live in that is currently making me miserable. That idea is a really important and profound one. And it wasn't just an important, profound one in the 1960s. It is central, I think, to the way that we experience and think about politics today in a really good way. Sometimes when you hear people critique this way of thinking, they'll use the term identity politics, like as a kind of throwaway. Like, that's identity politics. That's some other thing. That's people whining because they don't like their life. But the profound insight at the heart of the personal is political is that our lives as private citizens and as human beings, the most intimate relationships we have, marriage, parenthood, our workplace relationships, our friendships, they're all bound up in a set of political structures that give some people power and take power away from others. And what identity politics, for lack of a better word, or politics in general tries to do is understand those structures. Brittany Cooper is someone who I think writes about the personal being political as well, if not better, than anyone else writing today. She is a Black woman. She has a new book out called Eloquent Rage that is partly a memoir, but really it's a book-length meditation about what it means for her to come to understand the personal being political in her life. And I think she has a way of explaining the force and the power of that phrase, of that way of thinking that very few people have, that allows us, particularly people who are outside of her particular experience, like myself, to sort of interrogate how we see the world, the invisible structures that may have put us where we are, and to have a kind of public conversation about the world we want to have that doesn't get bogged down in a lot of the kind of cramped forms of debate that you see around the issue of quote-unquote identity politics. So Brittany Cooper has this kind of deep brilliance and empathy and kind of cutting astuteness to the way that she sees the world, the way she writes about her own experience, that I think allows us to have a much, much smarter conversation about this broad topic that we call identity politics. And when I say identity politics, what I mean by identity politics is all of politics. Because every conversation we have these days, particularly in the era of Donald Trump, who is knows identity politics as well as any politician in American history, all politics we talk about are identity politics. All the debates we have, whether it's about people being kicked out of a Starbucks or it's about the president's immigration policy, they come back to who we think we are, what identities we embrace, who has power in the society, and whether they feel like they belong. If there's one person who I feel is able to explain the best parts of understanding our political life through that personal prism, it is Brittany Cooper. I feel like you write about the intersection of the personal and political as well as anyone writing today. I feel like you have this way of combining the two, of moving through the two, and of being really raw and honest. No, seriously. And maybe that's because, like, we're friends on Facebook, too, so I get, like, the whole uncensored thing.
Poor thing. Sorry.
I get the whole thing. But the reason I wanted to talk to you is because I feel like you've got, in some ways, you have won the meritocratic lottery. And I don't mean that in, like, you won it through luck. Like, you worked very hard. You're obviously an extremely talented individual. You've got inner talents that you have honed through hard work and discipline. You're the paradigmatic American success story.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Like, tell me about what your upbringing was and tell me about how you got from there to here.
Sure. So I grew up with a single mother in a small town in Louisiana. My father struggled with alcohol addiction. He was violent and abusive. He left our home when I was 5, but he was subsequently killed in a domestic dispute involving trying to protect another love interest when I was 9 years old. I also tell the story of he and my mother and their coming together and how their love story is shaped by violence, by the way in which a lover that my mother dated before she dated my father was angry that she chose to move on and date my father and eventually comes and shoots both of them, shoots my mother, shoots my father. And then weeks later, my mother does survive and she finds out that she's pregnant with me and that she has kept her pregnancy through this very violent attack. And so my coming into being and my childhood are shaped by violent, horrific forms of violence. My father gets shot several times in my lifetime and he's only alive till I'm 9 years old. But the saving grace in the middle of that is that at some point, a teacher in my elementary school, in my public school, notices that I can read really well. And she moves me from a sort of segregated middle track classroom. She talks to the teacher who teaches the next level up and says, can I send her to your class for reading and math? And that teacher agrees. And it sets me on the path and I take off. And the same year that my father gets killed, I have this like one black teacher who says, this kid is talented. I'm going to invest in her. My test scores leap 10% in 1 year. This is, you know, the kind of thing that we're trying to incentivize with teachers now. So I take off. I become, you know, I go on. I have a great, you know, career. I am the valedictorian of my high school class, college on full scholarship, PhD by 28. And I'm thankful for that story. But I often think about all of the kids who were in my class, who were just as smart, who didn't have the supports and who didn't make it. And I want to call it actually angst. If there's anything millennial about me, I do have some angst around. So in broader America, we call it an American story. In black communities, we think about it as the politics of respectability, right? Mm-hmm. You follow all the rules. You are articulate. You are a rule follower. You know, law abiding, all those things. And success can be yours. That story worked for me. It worked shockingly well.
In fact, you're the cudgel. You, Brittany Cooper, and your success with the story that you just told us.
Yes.
Are the cudgel.
Yes.
Wielded by people.
Yes, exactly. I get weaponized. You know, I tell a story in this book about my god sister who, you know, at some point she and I drift apart and she becomes part of a crew of black girls who bully me in school. And when I tell my mom and my mom calls her folks because we're basically family, you know, her people say to her, you need to be more like Brittany. So even in my childhood, I get wielded and weaponized against other children as a marker of that the things that are happening to them are because of their poor choices, not because of a bit of luck like the structural story sort of comes together for me in a way that it doesn't for some of my
classmates. But that's what I found. The book is remarkably honest and remarkably well-written. When I read the book, I was thinking to myself, that is a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
Like, even hearing you talk about it now, I could feel like a little pinch in your voice. Like,
absolutely.
It's a lot of trauma.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it is. And look, I don't even know that I knew I was that traumatized until I wrote this book. Because when you become a Black girl overachiever, sometimes overachievement can become the drug. It can become the coping mechanism. You never slow down. You just keep going because you're trying to make a way. And so this was the first time that I had slowed down and had deeply reflected on, you know, as we like to say, all that I've been through. But for me, what I care about is I didn't want to believe in the myth of my own exceptionalism. I don't want to believe it because I don't believe it, right?
But talk about that first part. You don't want to believe it.
I don't want
it's
to believe
like
it.
It's like a faith.
It is because I was set up to believe it, right? You know, I'm achieving and I've got a lot of Black kids in my community who are bullying me and saying, literally saying this Obama story, right? You're acting white. You want to be white. And I experienced that. That was my childhood. I didn't particularly grow up having Black friends because I got ostracized from the community as someone who was ultimately trying to approximate whiteness. And what happens, I mean, one, what happens is that I get to go to historically Black college. And I talk about the first day being on campus, being the first day of my life that I'm not presumed to be the smartest Black kid in the classroom, and how just that was like both intimidating and exhilarating at the same time. So that was very helpful to me. But because I then got a political analysis there, I was like, all of a sudden I was able to go back and reflect on my story and recognize the ways that ultimately this is like a story of luck. This is not actually a story about my particular ingenuity. And that's not trying to take anything away from myself. It's trying to say there's all kinds of genius in my community. There were other Black children in the higher level classes with me, and their trajectory has been really different because the levels of support you have to make it out, they had to have everything go right. So if one thing went wrong, it could derail you forever. And that's the thing I don't think we talk about enough, that is what it means. When we say this hard luck, pull yourself up by your bootstraps story, it still is reliant on you never having a bad day in school, talking to a teacher, getting pulled out of class. You know, just none of the things can happen. Or it's you can be a great kid, but even when I was doing well, I had racist teachers who intimidated me, who made me cry every day. And the only thing that helped is that my mother felt confident enough in her own ability to advocate for me that she would come to the school. And she had the kind of job that was forgiving enough that she could take off for an hour of her day and come without it meaning that she was going to lose her job. And so if you don't have just all of those levels of support, then you can be derailed at any moment.
I think about second chances a lot in the context of the world that I saw, which is a very different story. I grew up in the Bronx in sort of a middle-class family, and then sort of went to a magnet school, which was interesting from a class perspective, and then to an Ivy League college, and again, interesting from a class perspective, and watching the ways in which people with enough power or affluence or privilege can fail and get back
still
up,
okay.
Right, and get second chances. And you watch people with addiction, mental health struggles. You know, human stuff. Like
That we all have.
Yeah, that we all have, right? Like, not like, oh, they're these bad people with addiction and mental health. Like,
sure.
That's human life. And the ability to be able to get back up from that.
Yeah.
One of the things you're wrestling with in the book is figuring out how do you merge your understanding of you as an individual and you as a product of structure.
That's
seriously.
Right. Yeah, no. There's this moment that I think many overachieving Black women have where they recognize the ways that the structure gets you anyway. Mm-hmm. So I talk about how, you know, I'm 37. I'm single. I don't have children. I don't own property. What I have is a lot of degrees. That's what I have. I don't have wealth that attends to those things. I don't have all of the other sort of stuff that comes with it. And so in some ways, you know, I think a lot in this book about the ways that I become a different kind of statistic. I become the kind of overachieving Black woman that has degrees, but has struggled to find kind of romantic partnership. And while that's shifting, thankfully, it has been a long road. And the shift didn't happen when I was in my prime childbearing years. I think about my struggles with infertility and the way that often catches up to Black women who make all the choices. So for me, because my mother was a teen mother, my one narrative was don't have a baby. So now I'm 37 and I have the kind of life where I could have a kid, but I can't really easily have a kid. So it catches you.
That is some.
Oh, yeah. You want to cuss. You just want to cuss.
It is. I mean, because it's like, okay, I did it.
I did everything right. And now here we are. And look, my mom, even in, you know, I talk in this book about how my mom buys our first home. And she buys it largely because I become a latchkey kid so that she doesn't have to pay daycare cost. And with it, because of where we lived in the country, within a year's time, she saved enough money to sort of initiate the process for buying a home. I'm 37 and I don't own property because of the, you know, in that way, this my story is like very millennial. That there is a way in which I have not been able to build on the generational progress that even my mother was able to make because of I live in a different part of the country, demands are different, et cetera. So the structures catch you. They catch you even when you're an individual overachiever. And it's that thing that I want to say to folks around why we can't just invest all our energy in being our very best selves and the ways in which that can become insufficient.
The other side of this. Right. And I'm going to jump into the shoes of someone that is not me, but I can relate to a little bit.
Sure.
Some little voice in my head.
OK.
Which is a straight white man who doesn't get all the complaining.
Sure.
OK. No, because this and one of the, I see this happen all the time in the discussions we have. You know, there's that joke about the two fish swimming. The two young fish are swimming through the water and an old fish comes by and says, beautiful day, enjoy the water. And one fish says the other, like, what's water?
Yes.
And the joke is they don't know what they're swimming in. That's just the way, that's what, right?
They've always, yeah.
So if you're a upper middle class straight white man, right? You don't know what the water is.
Yeah.
The structural stuff is so invisible by design. That's the whole point.
Yeah, exactly.
But what you do know is I got bullied. I got my heart broken by mean girls. I was ostracized. I felt hurt. I've felt like I've struggled. I've had bad bosses. I feel like I can't catch a break. I feel like I'm unlucky in love. I feel like yada, yada, because you're a human.
Sure.
And there's a way in which I can watch people get defensive of their own inner lives.
Yeah.
When confronted with the kinds of structural truth that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of things about that. One is that I want, you know, the straight white man in your head to, I want him to be able to hear that first, it's interesting that the points of connection make him feel defensive rather than connected. Like, why doesn't it inspire any kind of empathy? Like, I see this happening and let me understand another person's experience of it and how it might be different. So I wonder about that. It's that defensiveness that becomes the problem because the story that I'm telling is not just a Black girl story. Many professional women struggle with, I put my career first and now what do I do? How do I build a family? How do I have a partnership? All of those things. The other thing though that I've said to the, you know, had a straight white man come to one of my book talks and confront me and talk about how, you know, how
they will always do that. That's the other thing.
Absolutely. They don't take up all the space in the room and confront me and ask me to defend. And the thing that I said to him is, what happens if you entertain the notion that being a white man doesn't mean that you can understand every experience? Like, what happens if you just have to concede that maybe there are some parts of this that you just don't get, but even in the not getting, that doesn't mean that they're not true, that they're not real. There's this enduring joke that happens among Black folks, particularly when we're online, about how we watch HGTV and how we see white families. And it's like, the guy is like, I'm a businessman. And his wife is like, I'm a, you know, stay at home mom. And our budget is $900,000. And you know, there's, and like me and my friends who are like, upper middle class, we are professors, and our budget is nowhere near that. And we talk to each other and go, how are white people living? Like, what kind of money do they have and where is it? Because we have some of the best jobs that you can have, and we don't understand. And so we have to acknowledge all the time that there's just some stuff that we don't, that in our experience, we don't have access to. And I think what happens if we see that as a common ground? Maybe I don't get your whole story. But here are the points of connection that I get.
I think as a white person, I'm trying to do a better job of understanding that emotional place of other white people.
Sure.
Partly because I feel like that emotional labor shouldn't be done by non-white folks. Sure. Like, I feel like it's kind of on us to do it, but it's also like the guy that comes to your book event to... What? I just want to sit down for an hour of therapy and be like, what's up, dude? No, seriously, I really mean that.
Yeah.
What are you feeling right now? What are you holding right now inside that heart of yours that is making you come to Brittany Cooper's event?
And show up. Yeah, but you know, part of it is really something basic, which is that folks don't want to feel like they're bad. People don't want to feel like they're terrorists, like they're like they're the cause of someone else's pain. And part of what it means to grapple with whiteness is that as a political project, it's so deeply tethered to dominance and causing pain to other people that that's what's true. And the thing that I always want to be saying to people is the issue is not trying to hold the weight of whiteness, you know, in your, it is trying to do the work of justice. Like, why can't that be the shift? Like, we don't need you to hold the weight of every, you know. Yeah.
Just that is my thing about like allyship as a category or all of this. It gets very like confessional and touchy feely about how I feel. It's like, look, just go out, do me a favor, go out and like go knock on some doors for like the DA candidate in your borough who's like trying to make sure not everyone's locked up.
That's right.
And just do that.
That's right.
Take
and,
all
and
the
live
eggs.
Your life. That's right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to have your language all the way right. Trying to do some good still matters. And I don't, you know, I didn't write this book because I wanted white people to feel guilty. I'm just uninterested in it.
Yeah.
I wrote it because I was like, there is a way for us to change this. And it gets back to some basic principles around, do you like women as people? When women speak, do you listen to them? Do you have substantive relationships with women that you're not trying to have sex with? Like, what is the quality of the relationships with the women and also queer folk in your life? Because that'll shift and shape your politics. We could begin there. And that feels like a more tangible and like, you know, it's a bit
welcoming
easier to,
or something.
Yeah, like something to enter in that you can kind of do. It's a little bit you can bite off. You know, you're not biting off more than you can chew. That's the thing that for me seems to matter. Because when I talked about Beyonce in this book, I watched as Black feminists ripped her apart. When she came out in 2013 with the Beyonce album, when she came out in 26, less with Lemonade. With Lemonade,
there was a transformation, I felt like, because, in the critical.
Because, I mean, but it's so messed up. It was like, oh, wow, your life isn't perfect. We don't hate you anymore.
Right, right.
Which I appreciated that she was transparent, but why do we need folks to suffer before we feel like we can connect? That, to me, is a terrible iteration of Black feminism. So I wanted to have a conversation a little bit with Black women in this book about what is the thing with Beyonce? Like, what is she triggering? What is it about? In the end, you know, for me, it just comes down to a Mean Girls thing. She's pretty and she's famous and she's got, you know, lots of money and she's got this dude and he's, you know, all right or willing to change or something. And lots of Black girls who are feminist want that. And we don't necessarily have it. And I feel like this just, we're mad. It's like you can have, if you get all of the trappings of the, you know, that structures try to keep from us, then what you can't have is woke politics. You can't have feminism too. That's for those of us who don't get all the things. I actually do really think that's what's going on. And I think there might be lots of other sophisticated things we can say. But in the end, I just think it's like middle school stuff, middle school trauma that we don't work out well.
But that's my weird... My theory about all of politics is middle school trauma
yes,
that we
I
don't work out
with.
Well.
No.
I mean, that's what I mean. Like, that's why I think this. That's why I think these conversations about identity politics get so loaded and so freighted. Because my fundamental belief is that being a human in the world is hard.
Yes.
Now, Southern. That doesn't mean it's equally hard for everyone.
Sure.
In fact, it's much harder for some people than others.
Sure.
But the subjective experience of being a human in the world,
is hard.
Of being a Beyonce in the world,
is hard.
Of being President George W. Bush, like people with tremendous privilege, people who do terrible things,
sure.
By the way.
The but it's hard.
The universal feeling of walking around in this little thing when you're like pulling the levers of the robot is the hardness.
It's hard.
And I feel like there's a fundamental way in which our politics are broken.
Yeah.
To talk about that. You know?
Yeah.
And to make space for other people. Like, to get back to the idea that, like, what we're trying to do here is get people to flourish, people to love, people to be happy.
Yeah.
And it feels like the opposite, right? It feels like we're, like, grabbing at that space or something. Or we're having a tug of war. Like, there's like it's a piece of pizza that only one of us is going to get to eat.
The whole thing. That's right. There's a resentment towards what people call identity politics, which, and when what they really mean is more people are being able to tell their story.
That's right.
And that is so interesting. You know, why do we see more information as harmful rather than as clarifying? That if this,
right.
that if it's hard for all of us, at the point that we can see that it's hard for all of us, then we know that it's a structural problem, right? It's not just like Black overachieving women who are single. We're seeing more singleness in the country in general. People are getting married less or staying married less. And so that shift is going to affect the quality of life of people. Isolation, you know, is a bigger killer in some ways in old age than many of the chronic diseases
Absolutely.
That we have. And so we have, so what does it mean if we think about what's happening with Black women as a harbinger of things that are to come for the country? This is the thing we keep learning about people of color. 50 years ago, folks were like, Black women are having all these babies out of wedlock and, you know, daddies aren't in the home. Here we are now, and the New York Times is writing op-eds about creative family structures and the way that people are redefining the modern family. We were redefining it 50 years ago, and it became a marker of like, and back then it was pathology, now it's creativity. So what happens if we look at what's happening with Black communities who are the first to experience the cracks of empire, since we know that the empire is cracking and crumbling? And so everyone is going to experience it. If we look at what's happening to us and say, what does it look like to fix or help assuage this? Then you help everybody. That's a thing we know. That's a thing we know.
That is a great point. And also true about what the whole conversation about the white working class is about the experience of whiteness.
Yeah.
Literally recapitulating all of these sort of tropes that had been attached to Blackness,
yeah,
right?
That's it.
And we see it. We see it in the data, like out of wedlock births, right? Things like that.
All of it. Look, the middle class is shrinking, and it is shrinking because of a set of capitalist policies that all of us should be horrified by. So sometimes I want to say to white people, your anxiety is real. We are working harder for less money. That's true for everybody. I was like, if I go in any room and say, who's exhausted? Everybody's tired, right? That's a capitalist problem of you work more, you get less wages, wage stagnation is real. All folks are experiencing a version of that in some way. And the problem is that then you look at people of color as the folks that you resent and say that they're taking something from you rather than thinking, no.
Right.
This is something about like shifting power up to big corporations. This is something about a sort of profits over people mentality. Like one of the things that I always say when I listen to my peers and even my white peers talking about parenting their children and all of the stress of parenting kids, I'm like, so much of the anxiety about play dates and schools and all of that is you want to make sure that your kid is a have versus a have not. You want to make sure your
100%.
Kid is in the middle class in a moment when you know resources are shrinking.
You feel like it literally feels like you are training for an Olympic team where there's like, there's 100 kids out there and the team's going to select 20.
Yeah.
Like that is the model of parenting, particularly in affluent communities.
Yeah.
Affluent white communities, but affluent communities more broadly as a kind of class statement. That's what it is. It's like, and sometimes it's literal. Sometimes it's literally the good school has 20 slots,
right?
So sometimes it's like actually made mathematically manifest. But the structure of parenting in these conditions produces the zero-sum thinking that you and I are talking about is like the basic of all this stuff at the center of our politics. Like, we're competing for that slot.
Yeah. No, that's it. And so from the outside looking in as an auntie to various children, I'm listening to my friends and I'm like, well, of course you're exhausted because you feel like this kid has to be in every activity. They got to be scheduled all the time. My mother was like, child, I bought you toys. Go play with them. You'll be fine. You know, and I know now that parents don't feel that sort of leisure. But why don't we see it? Why is the solution? My kid is going to be one of the 20
exactly right.
rather than. Why are there only 20 slots? What does it look like for us to have policy so that there's more than 20 slots? It's like the inability to make that shift is the thing that keeps messing us up.
And that's the whole thing. To me, that's the place where we individual, and that is the American pathology, is that we individualize as opposed to think collectively or politically, right?
That's right.
So like, it's like we take political issues, we make them personal as opposed to
we take personal issues, we look at them as political.
Right.
That's
like,
it.
That, like, we think, I am failing, why can't I keep up? And the people who learn not to do that are really affluent people.
Yeah.
So, like, this is a thing I learned. I learned my dad from who's a community organizer. He was like, no one organizes like rich people. Mm. He's like, you want to talk about collective power, like, go check out a homeowners association in like a nice neighborhood sometimes.
Yeah.
You want to talk about like how people get together and they're like, we have a collective problem. Like,
that's right.
There's too much shade being thrown on our on our pool.
That's right.
Because this developer wants to build a new building.
That's right.
No. We shall collectively organize. And it's not like, man, that's a bummer. Right. We're not going to get tan. No. That is a political problem.
Absolutely.
And people with power know how to do that. That's right. A thing that people, I think, with a certain amount of privilege and power learn how to do that's taught and passed down is like actually to make those things political. It's so hard to think in those terms.
Yeah.
For other folks, I think.
That's one of the core things for me is what does it look like to get to see your particular issues as a political problem? Because I'm thinking about this. I've been thinking watching the, watching the Parkland kids, watching this, Austin bomber. And one of the things that I always think whenever there are these sort of issues of domestic terrorism at the hands of white men, and, you know, particularly in the Austin bomber's case, they talked about how he was going through things in his life. Mm. And I always think, white men actually do conclude that their personal stuff should become the community problem. That's always the calculation when you go shoot up a school, is that my inability, my things that I'm angry about, I should take it out on everyone. That's right. Mm-hmm. But look, there is a more productive version of that, right? The sort of privilege to, the thing about communities of color and the thing about, like, for me, what I took from my mother's struggles was that, I mean, I wouldn't say that I went around judging her, but I looked at her life and I assessed and I said, oh, here are all the places where you made wrong choices. And so I won't make those wrong choices. And then I won't have the trajectory that you had. I will have a different trajectory. And again, that's an individual that in some ways it's imbibing shame from those choices and saying that if I wanted a better life for myself, I would make different choices. And here's the thing. If my mother calls me and I'm screwing up at my life, that's what a pep talk sounds like from her. I assume that if you want different things to happen, then you'll do different things to get it. Like, you know,
right.
And I realized that that's who my mother is.
Okay, but then this is to me is like the final question here, which is that it is also the case that at the same time you got to think structurally and politically, you got to take responsibility for the things you do in your life.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, say this to white people, right? Like,
I'm not saying it to you, obviously. I'm saying that, like,
I know.
One place that I saw this most intensely is amazing group in New York City called the Osborne Association. Mm-hmm. They work with the incarcerated, the families of the incarcerated, the formerly incarcerated.
Sure.
And they work with on two tracks, right? So they do like actual stuff in prisons, mm-hmm. stuff with ex-offenders, and then reform.
Sure.
Right? And one of the things they do that I think is so interesting is they maintain these two tracks.
Sure.
Which is, it is a structural problem, the amount of people we put in prison, particularly the amount of people of color.
Sure.
Also, you, individual, who assaulted someone, need to come to terms with what you did.
Sure.
And ask for forgiveness for that and work through why you did that. And that those two things are not, you know, they have very radical politics and radical belief in self-responsibility next to each other.
Sure.
Like they are kind of combining the structural and the individual in this really fascinating way to me.
I like that. And I think, and I would say to you that I think it's the thing that I try to live out, but in my own life, that the issue is never, for me, the issue was never about whether I would take personal responsibility. The issue
No,
was,
your whole book is about a person who.
Yeah, but I'm trying to say, right, for other folks who are listening, though, one of the things I say in this book, and I do think it's right, but the problem with neoliberalism, a big, you know, big fancy term, which in this iteration just means that we privatize stuff that is supposed to be public. We
right.
make personal things that are structural. And so all we do is preach at people and say, you should have made better choices.
Right.
But my question about the structural and the thing that and the reason why the model that you're talking about works is only because here is the assumption that they're making, that yes, you should make better choices, but you can only make better choices if you have better options.
That's right.
And so what they're doing is creating a world in which there's a different set of options. And now you optimize people's ability
right.
to think through. The issue becomes that we keep on yelling at people about how their reality is a function of their bad choices. And there is less reckoning with the ways in which our current structure keeps on narrowing the options available. Even, as we said, to an affluent family who is trying to make sure their kid gets educated, it's a narrowing of options if you say only 20 kids can make it. And your kid is the kid who is like, yeah, I could read, or I could just think my own thoughts, or I don't want to talk to people, or I'm an introvert. Like, all of these sort of things that you work out with time, but you might not be an overachiever initially. That's right. And so that's a narrowing of options. That's and the right. fact that we see it happening across class, across race, across all kinds of demographics should be the basis for solidarity rather than competition.
Solidarity rather than competition is a good, I think, a good watchword. Brittany Cooper is a professor of gender studies at Rutgers University. She is the author of Eloquent Rage, which you can buy right now. It's a fantastic book. It's a quick read. It's a fun read. It's a really, really, really great book. Brittany, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Chris.
Why Is This Happening? Is presented by MSNBC and NBC News Think, produced by the All In team with music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more from Brittany right now with her new piece on NBC News Think. Visit think.nbcnews.com to read it.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.